Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Plowman's Folly when we come back. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small. But you shall have a perfect and a just weight. A perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention back in 1787 followed that scriptural principle of law when they put into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words. They say, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." But in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation, and in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced into our current economic practice, our monetary system, the first, the second, and the fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto. And they gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coin. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our nation? Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in my business school. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, why don't you go to our website? It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free General Law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Plowman's Folly, Edward H. Faulkner. You can probably get a copy of the book published by the University of Oklahoma Press back in 1943. I don't think it's exactly rare. I have 4 or 5 copies around the library here. When I'm in a used bookstore and I see a copy, I buy it. I don't know why. I've already read it 5 times. I don't need any more copies, but I just see them there, and I'm afraid they're going to go to waste. I'm afraid that nobody's going to buy it, and so I buy it. I think I paid, you know, $10 or so for a copy. It's only, hell, it isn't even 200 pages, I don't think. 160 pages. But it'll tell you what the problem is with the soil. And it's very simple. It's organic material in the soil. It's organic material in the soil, whether you're growing a garden in downtown Cleveland or you're growing wheat, corn, soybeans, or something else on 5,000 or 10,000 acres. It's organic material in the soil. That's the key to soil fertility. It's the key to controlling hurricanes. It's the key to maintaining the soil and keeping it from eroding. Now, we have a thing here called soil types. You ever heard that? What type of soil do you have? I'm asked that quite often. My soil type is rock. I have rock here, interspersed with clay. My soil type here is rock and clay, and that's the good soil. That's the good stuff. Organic material, I would say, was that. Hell, we don't know what that is here where I'm from. Now, we used to have soil here on this ground. I mentioned that a time or two, but we needed to exploit the timber resources back in the 1880s and 1890s and early 1900s so that we could build more and more railroads, which we did. And we came in here and clear cut this. And then it rained on it, and it washed all of our organic material south to New Orleans, which was not all bad for you guys down in New Orleans because it built up all of that water land or that watershed that you've got south of New Orleans and kept the hurricanes at bay, but as we discussed the last time. But the bottom line is that even that's been dissipated now. You know, we've built up all these levees, channeled it out into the Gulf of Mexico. I guess we're intent upon building a causeway across to Yucatan. Maybe that's what our goal is. But people ask the question, well, what kind of soil type do you have? Well, you know, 100 years ago, we didn't need to be concerned about soil types. We weren't very scientific. Everybody had one soil type. It was good soil. And it grew whatever it was you planted in it. Today, boy, that's not the case. That's not the case. What we're really measuring here is the chemical composition of the soil. We're measuring the mineral composition. We're talking about colonizing Mars and in building an atmosphere on Mars. We want to play God. But we can't even emulate what God has created for us here on planet Earth. Going to Mars, you can forget about. Let's concentrate on planet Earth and let's see if we can get it right here first. And then let's talk about colonizing Mars and Neptune and Pluto or some other place and developing atmospheres when we've got the capacity to do it. So far, we haven't been able to follow instructions here on planet Earth. Now, when Columbus and the explorers who followed him first saw our land, there was nothing about the soil to distinguish those variations in appearance and behavior that we now designate as soil types. Even after the European trespass had been well underway for several generations, it would have been impossible to determine whether most of the virgin soils were chiefly clay, silt, or sand. The whole face of the earth lay under the mingled, and it was mingled with a mass of organic matter so manifest as to defy the best effort of man to discover the characteristic distribution of the soil's mineral content. Nowhere, or almost nowhere, could soils have been classified into categories more specific than the broad general groups now known as the forest, grassland, desert, and intermediate. Soil types as we now know them have become gradually discernible as the black disguise of organic matter has disappeared, as soils have become unproductive through the uncompensated removal of organic matter from it. It has become possible for us now to classify these minerals into an intricate system of groups and subgroups with very different characteristic appearance and behavior. No attempt will be made to clarify the highly technical matter of soil classification in this book. For such information, the reader can now be directed to an extremely readable book on the subject written by a man whose acquaintance with the subject is probably unmatched in this country. He's Charles E. Kellogg, Chief of the Soil Survey, United States Department of Agriculture. It was published late 1941. His book is called The Soils That Support Us, and in my opinion, there is no easier source from which the layman can obtain correct information on the subject at hand. So after reading Mr. Kellogg's book, the reader who wishes more detailed information about the characteristic soil types of a given area of his country will find much helpful data in Soils and Men, the yearbook of the United States Department of Agriculture for 1938. And if you want more detail, then for limited areas such as counties, it can be had by consulting the soil map if you have been issued, or one has been issued for your county. But our concern here is to determine how the soils that we have damaged can be rehabilitated without our having to await the repetition of the natural processes by which they were originally created, which takes thousands of years. Is there some way to recreate soil And the answer is, yes, there is. Soil creation is, in nature, a very long, drawn-out process. People, now threatened by famine, view with apprehension the supposed necessity for throwing our present depleted soils back into forest or grassland and waiting for several generations for the time when a new set of soils may be cleared. Now, just how these intervening generations can subsist in the interim is not at all clear. And there is ample justification for the gloom which is displayed by many of our foremost students of soils. The present chapter is intended to mitigate the fears engendered by such cheerless forebodings. All right, now let me pause right here. I built 6 raised beds. I took a look at this soil 20 years ago and I said, oh my God. You know, I'm from California where they got real dirt. I mean, you can dig a post hole where I'm from with a shovel. It takes an hour to dig a post hole here with bars and picks. I'm telling you, boys and girls, with bars and picks, it takes an hour. I could dig a post hole with a shovel in 10 minutes where I'm from. So when I got here and I took a look at this, it made me want to puke. I thought this has got to be the rectum of creation. Well, it probably is, but nevertheless, what do you do to live here on the poorest land that God ever put on planet Earth? Actually, it wasn't the poorest land that God put on planet Earth. It had 2 feet of topsoil on it in 1880. There was nothing wrong with this land. 2 feet of topsoil is nothing wrong with 2 feet of topsoil. But it was destroyed in just 2 generations. From 1880 to 1920, 40 years is 1 generation in biblical reckoning. I don't know where we got onto the idea that a generation is 20 years. I don't know where that came from. Tain't true, and that's what we call it today. 2 generations, 1880 to 1920 was 1 generation. Actually, by 1940, it had been destroyed 60 years. 1.5 generations. 3 as we reckon them today. Destroyed. So I looked at this destroyed land here about 20 years ago, and I said, what am I going to do? So I built 6 raised beds, because here, topsoil, good, black, rich earth topsoil, is at such a premium that we pack it up in wheelbarrows and move it around. And it takes about 40 wheelbarrows in a raised bed to put in, you know, to fill it up of railroad ties. Railroad ties are about 8 inches thick or so, 6 or 8 inches thick. And I put these railroad ties out, and one tie wide is 6.5 feet, and then I stretched out the ties, you know, 60 feet long. So 6.5 feet by 60 feet, about 40 to 50 wheelbarrow loads will fill that up. And then it decays down. And I put organic material in there. I hauled cow manure in there. I loaded it up, you know, with a fork out in the field. I went down and I took a hoe and I scratched the topsoil that had accumulated under cedar trees up into little piles. And then loaded them in a wheelbarrow, and I put them in my raised beds. I collected the soil here and put it in those raised beds. I've got 6 raised beds on the west side of the lane, and I can feed 20 people off of those 6 raised beds, 2,400 square feet for a year. Now, that's how productive good soil is. Now, outside of those raised beds, I don't think you could grow a carrot on this farm. Outside of those raised beds, I don't think a carrot would grow. And that's because we don't have any soil to put it in anywhere else. That's how bad the ground is here. Now, Faulkner in this book took clay soil up in Indiana, where he lived, or Ohio, I forgot now which, but Indiana or Ohio. And in 7 years, he turned that clay soil into good organic soil filled with organic material. He built dirt in 7 years. It does not take 1,000 years. You can do it in less time. At least you can do it in 7 years or in less time on little small pieces of ground. Now, if you're going to do this over extended acreage, you know, 5,000 acres, now that takes cover crops. It can be done. It can be done. But it costs money. It takes time, effort, and energy. It takes work. We came in here and raped, robbed, and pillaged the land. Now there's no more to rape, rob, and pillage. Now we got to go to work. So roll up your sleeves, boys and girls, and let's learn how to do it. Now, the development of pessimism among soil scientists is understandable if you study the history of thought on the subject of fertility maintenance as it has progressed in the past 30 years. This period has witnessed the most active efforts the world has yet known, chiefly here in the United States, to restore soil to its original ability to produce. A number of ideas helped initiate this wave of national interest in soil improvement. There is the established fact that rural populations have been steadily declining while urban populations have been increasing. The prediction has been freely made that in a few decades the world's population may be too great for the food-producing capacity of our soils. There has been the increasing conviction also that the science of chemistry might hold the secret of permanent fertility for the soil. Such influences helped to initiate government-sponsored agencies whose purpose was to inform farmers generally of the need for definite practices looking to soil improvement. Universally, the practices recommended involved cash expenditures at one point or another. Moreover, it soon became evident that the maintenance of fertility in soils which still produced fair crops is much easier to accomplish than the restoration of productive ability in soils which have lost all of their original black smudge. I'm going to pause right here and make a comment. In 1943, when Faulkner wrote this book, he said, we're at a crossroads here. We're going to do this organically or we're going to do it chemically. Okay, well, we got to the fork in the road, and we decided to move to the left, chemically. And so here in America, we have adopted chemical agriculture. Now, the chemical agriculture has made it possible for us to mine even more of the organic material out of the soil than we could have mined had we continued on the organic right path or the right turn. So what happens here is this. If soil is at its maximum capacity, I mean it's got all the organic material that it can possibly hold. We have this pure virgin soil. I have created that down here in my 6 raised beds. I mean, you can't get any more organic, boys and girls, when you bring in cow manure in piles, in wheelbarrows, and put it in a box. That's as organic as it gets. At that point, you got to bring in some organic or inorganic rock to mix with it, which I did. Now, as time progresses, when you go out here in your garden and you pick a carrot, you bring it in the house and you eat it, and then your poops go down your sewer, the organic material that is represented in that carrot came out of that cow manure which you brought into that closed ecological system in a wheelbarrow out of the field, boys and girls. Can you understand that? And once it goes down your toilet, it's gone. Now, the Chinese are a little smarter than we are. They call that night soil. They collect that and they put it back out on their garden. Which, if we had any smarts in this country, instead of taking that sewer sludge over there and calling it a waste product, we would be taking that sewer sludge and we'd be putting it back on our soils again. It's called night soil.
In this country, that's a deadly practice because when it goes down your public sewer, it gets mixed with mercury and heavy metals and cadmium and all kinds of chemicals and toxins, which make it total death for any organism that that sewage sludge is put upon. Now talk about pollution. You know, the Bible talks about that. He says, here's our God speaking now. He says, you have polluted my inheritance. God created a great inheritance over here, and we polluted it. Well, we can say that again. But I mean, you know, assuming that you weren't, sticking all of your industrial chemicals down your sewer system and running them out here in the same sewage treatment plant over here to make the sludge to throw out here on the ground to destroy it. Assuming that you didn't do that, you'd have a thing called night soil. Now, the system is self-perpetuating. The organic material, the waste that we humans, as Faulkner so adequately pointed out. You know, when a cow is eating grass, she is making manure at the rate of 35 pounds a day. This cow that's out here eating that grass is making 35 pounds of dirt, 35 pounds of soil, 35 pounds of organic material per day going in the ground. Now, you talk about a soil-making machine. When God made cows, boy, he wasn't whistling Dixie through a straw hat. He was making a soil-making machine. When 250 million buffalo, 250 million buffalo, were making 35 pounds of manure a day and spreading it over Iowa, Illinois, North and South Dakota, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Texas, he had a dirt-making machine. He had a soil-making machine there. That's why that soil built up at the rate of about 12 inches every 1,000 years. You know, you take that 3,000 years between the flood, actually about 4,000 years, I guess, between the flood and today, we have 4 feet of topsoil. Go out to some places, you know, there are still some places here in Iowa, Nebraska, and Illinois where the topsoil is 4, 5, 6 feet deep. Now, of course, a lot of that washed in there, you know, from floods. But it builds up at the rate of about 1 inch every 90 years, naturally. Just manure dropping on the ground. So, it's a process. And if we get into harmony with that process, you know, we can maintain that process. And it's a hell of a lot easier to maintain it than it is to build it. It's a lot easier to maintain, to keep, to hang on, to hold on to 2 feet of topsoil on your ground than it is to replace it after you have destroyed it. We Americans on this plateau, this is called the Ozarks Plateau. Little piece of high ground here in the middle of America. 40,000 square miles or so. Had 2 feet of topsoil on it. In 60 years, we destroyed it. Took us 60 years and we destroyed it all. Now there's a few pockets here and there where there's a little topsoil, you know. But by and large, we destroyed it. Now, can we rebuild it? The answer is yes, we can, but not by bulldozing down the forests. And here in the Ozarks, we are clearing land. I mean, my neighbor over here, God bless him, he's a nice guy. He's got a cat over there, and he just cleared off about another 40 or 50 acres of ground over here with a cat. Probably paid this guy $200-$300 an acre. Now they're going to go out and put chemical fertilizers on the ground, and then they're going to plant seeds. And they're going to get lush growth. Now the soil over there is very thin, just like mine is here, very thin. It grows grass in certain selected places. And if we take the certain selected places like the bottoms and then we leave the trees on the hillsides, you know, we can have both forests and grass, but we're not going to do that. They just bulldoze it off. It don't make any difference how steep it is. Bulldoze it down and put chemicals on it. Nobody thinks about organic material. It's the commercial man who comes to us and sells us this commercial fertilizer for the very short term. And boy, I'm telling you, over the short term, that is over, you know, 2-3 years. You're going to have great lush growth. Now, the ultimate end to this is death. If we continue on with this, we will all of us turn this ground into a Sahara Desert. That's where we're headed in the Ozarks Plateau. We're headed for the desertification of it. But, you know, still we've got lots of forest left, and we're at the point where some of us are clearing the land like some of us were drilling holes into the aquifer back in the 1920s and 30s. And as long as it's only some of us. But as our neighbors watch Don Uchman, and as they watch Halbert Smith, ultimately they're going to emulate that great short-term success. And pretty soon we are going to clear every tree off of this plateau. And when we do that, death and destruction will surely follow. Just like we're doing down here in Louisiana with the levees that we're building. I covered that last time with tile treachery. As we build more levees and channel the dirt deck out into the river, from the river down into the Gulf of Mexico, as we channel all of that silt down into the Gulf of Mexico, we are destroying that marshland south of New Orleans out into the Gulf, which is only going to exacerbate your hurricane problem down there. It isn't going to get any better. The oil industry isn't going to change anything. The Department of Agriculture isn't going to change anything. The Congress isn't going to change anything. And so we're going to get more of the same. We made the wrong turn to chemical agriculture. That was a wrong turn. Biologic agriculture was the right turn. We didn't make that one. And we're not going to. And we're not going back to it. So you and I as individuals then, you on your farm, and I mentioned last time, my neighbor over here, he cleared Ingram's place. And now the water, he won't hold the water on that place. It's 80 acres. That 80 acres, when it rains an inch, it just runs right off that 80 acres and right into the creek and then right down into my bottom. And then, of course, down off into the lake. I don't think that Don can see that. He's in the cattle business, and he wants more acres of grass to feed more cows. And there's no reason why he can't have grass, but you've got to have grass and trees. You've got to have trash on the ground. You've got to have organic material on the ground. We have to practice land Sabbath so that the grass grows up 1 year out of seven and we don't harvest it and it dies down and goes back into the soil to maintain that balance of organic material. That's the natural process. That's the process that created these virgin soils, these organic virgin soils that made America so productive agriculturally. And now, over vast regions of our country, we have destroyed our topsoils, and they are eroding away. And we're all sitting over going, well, what are we going to do? And so the college graduates that come from the cities, and then they go to work for the big corporations like Monsanto and Archer Daniels Midland Corporation, their main job is to add profit to the corporate bottom line. And they say, the best way for us to add profit to the corporate better bottom line is through chemical agriculture. And they're exactly right, and it makes all the sense in the world over the short term. But the ultimate end of it now is desertification, the destruction of the soil, and famine and starvation. And this is where Revelation 6 comes in, boys and girls. So get ready for it, because we have set it up. It's ready now. You've got a population that's increasing by 100 million people a year. You're destroying your soils as rapidly as possible, and you are consuming the water out of your aquifers, and your natural weather cycles are disrupted. Let me show you how you disrupt your natural weather cycles. In 1850, if you were standing on top of Mount Rose looking east, you would have seen forests stretching out into Nevada about 50 miles the forest land stretched out into Nevada 50 miles. Now go look at it today. Get up on top of Mount Rose on a clear day. That's assuming you can see 50 miles off of Mount Rose, which is becoming increasingly rare. Better yet, go down to Virginia City and just take a look. They discovered gold there, and so they went out and they cut the trees for mine timbers, and they built 7,000 miles of tunnel under that piece of real estate at Virginia City. 7,000 miles of tunnel. They cut every tree in the Nevada desert, which is desert today. There were trees out there. And then they went up on the Sierra side, and they went into Lake Tahoe, and they cut every tree out of Lake Tahoe. This is back in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, cut it all. Now today, much of that has grown back on the Sierra side. It has not grown back on the Nevada side. Not yet. And that's what happens with desertification. You take marginal land and you cut the trees off and you affect the weather. You get less and less rainfall. The reason you get less rainfall is because those trees give off moisture into the air, which goes up into the air and then precipitates down in the form of thunderstorms. We have those here. Here in the Midwest, we have those. You don't have them out in the West because you've got a lot of mineral earth sticking up there in Utah and Idaho, and you don't have the trees on it. Go to northern Idaho, you get more trees, and you get more precipitation. Wherever there are more trees, there's more precipitation. When you go to the jungle regions, you know, the tropics, you get 120 inches of rain, 90 inches of rain. Those are called tropical rainforests, where you get trade winds coming off the ocean, like you do in the Gulf of Mexico. You get more rain. All right, boys and girls, so if you want less rain, you need to cut down more trees. That's how simple that is. So out in the Sahara Desert, they have been cutting down trees for 2,000 years, and the desert's growing by 100 square miles a year. What you want to do is to dissipate and destroy the organic material in the soil. If you want more and more desert and less cropland, you need to destroy the organic material in the soil and the organic material, the forest on top of it. And the more of it you destroy, the more desert you'll get. And desertification is beginning to set in now in Iowa. Iowa, in the heartland of mid-America. Now, boys and girls, if we can create the Sahara Desert, we can turn the whole North American continent into a desert. And it's growing. And that's called chemical agriculture. Slash and burn will do it also. But chemical agriculture will do it a lot faster and a lot more efficiently. Hang on here and we'll give you a mid-course correction. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And while I'm thinking about it, these programs can all be downloaded on your computer in 32-bit format. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, we're reviewing a book called Plowman's Folly. And the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't necessarily mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not 100% endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Well, for many years, there was no means by which the government could assist farmers financially. In order for a farmer to do what was recommended, he must have either cash or credit. So multitudes of farmers who were greatly in need of assistance had neither. The result was that without so intending, we developed a more or less stratified series of agricultural classes in this country with distinct tendencies to specialization, thus producing several project classes. Some general farmers became beef cattle feeders, some became dairymen, some poultrymen, and so on. Many in each class retained a minimum of general farming practices while fully equipping themselves with the necessary mechanical accoutrements of their specialty. So because of their progress in this direction toward monoculture, many farmers became more and more dependent upon other farmers and then of the urban population for the necessities that they formerly had provided for themselves. So a commercialized, not to say industrialized, type of farming has been developed by those farmers who originally were able to follow the county agent's instructions. Now, while this grading up of a financially fortunate group of farmers was in progress, an equally effective degeneration was taking place among all of those farmers at the other end of the economic scale. Men whose land, prior to the launching of the government's agricultural programs back in the 1930s, had lost most of its organic matter were already so hard put financially that they could not adopt the most important recommendations of their advisors. They were willing, but very few of them had enough cash to enable their families to live comfortably. They could spare none for soil improvement. Belated recognition of the necessity and the necessary relation of soil degeneration to a lack of cash for soil improvement resulted ultimately in the establishment of legal provisions for aiding these distressed farmers in the rehabilitation of their lands. So a number of agencies are now in position to assist such farmers who can obtain loans for many projects for which money was formerly not available. In desperately needy situations, grants and aids can be made. In fact, so liberalized are the congressional acts and the regulations for their administration that every conceivable condition of agricultural distress can be relieved through one of several agencies, provided that it can be relieved by money. It was not, and it is not now, the intention of the government to expand the present programs to include all farmers whose land requires rehabilitation. So vast an undertaking would require more cash than the richest government in the world could scrape together by taxation. The hope, however, is that private lending agencies in the localities concerned will take over the job for their communities. In fact, in certain areas, this is being done in a small way. However, in the sections of the country where the need for soil improvement is most acute, the local banks, quite naturally, are in much the same poverty-stricken condition as their farmer customers. There is not, therefore, any very obvious solution for this paramount problem of soil rehabilitation. There are two other aspects of the matter that must be considered. It must be admitted that the per acre cost of production is necessarily increased by any measure which requires the establishment of terraces or other means of controlling runoff water. Terraces are engineering projects, the cost of which on poverty-stricken acres can easily amount to more than the previous value of the land per acre. Let me pause right there and point that out. That's precisely the point that we're trying to make here. In tile treachery, we saw that. In land, in its natural state, there weren't any tiles. There weren't any dikes and levees. There weren't any terraces. And there wasn't any excessive runoff. And that's because there was plenty of organic material in the soil, like a sponge or a blotter, to absorb the rains and then to hold that water during periods of dry, when there was drought. Today, ladies and gentlemen, what we're calling drought is simply a cycle of dry that could easily have been bridged by the organic material in the soils. But as we mined more and more of those organic materials out of the soil, we then had to rely upon irrigation, so that we could water that to mine more and more of the organic material out of the soil. Now we're down to where we have to put in hybridized seed along with the irrigation, along with the chemical fertilizers to mine more and more of the organic material out of the soil. We're now reaching the last stage of our destruction. We now have to have genetically modified seeds, along with the irrigation, along with the chemical fertilizer, so that we can mine more and more of the organic material out of the soil. You know, we're like a drunk. And the more we drink to get the same effect, we have to drink more and more because our bodies become more and more used to more and more of this alcohol. As we become more and more addicted to more and more chemical fertilizers, more and more sprays, more and more GMOs, more and more hybrid seed, more and more, it gets worse and worse until there finally reaches a point where nothing will solve the problem, and death must ensue. And that's what the book of Revelation is all about, and that's what Revelation 6 is depicting for us. We are now reaching very rapidly, boys and girls, that point in time when the aquifers are going dry at the very same time that soil fertility has now reached its lowest ebb, at the very same time that population has reached an apex. At the very same time, it all comes together in Revelation 6. That's the bottom line. Now, it's time for you and I to recognize the dire straits that we're in. And remember, I've mentioned this before. Let me mention it again. You don't need to pray to Jesus to solve your problem. He already told you. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, he said, "When you cry out to me at this juncture of time, Because of this king that you have placed over you, I will not hear you. So the religious people are busy praying to Jesus. They eat pig on Sunday afternoon and then pray to Jesus to cure their cancers. And he already told you, boys and girls, I ain't listening. So if you want to eat pig and pray to Jesus to cure your cancer, I think you're just going to die. I'm going to tell you a little story here. I had an old buddy, and he developed cancer. Nice guy. Nice guy. Nice wife. And at the time, I was involved with a church or with a church group, and I remember that these religious people in this church group, I wasn't all that religious myself. I just kind of observed, but I watched all these people pray for this guy. Hell, I prayed for him. I was real concerned about this guy. His name was Wegener. Not the composer, the musician, but his name was Wegener, a German guy. And he was a great guy, and he had cancer, and this cancer was kind of a long, slow, drawn out process. And this guy was degenerating. And every week you could see this guy was degenerating. He was getting sicker and sicker and weaker and weaker. And finally, you know, toward the end, he got to the point, he got so weak that he couldn't function anymore. So he laid on his deathbed and he finally died, which all of us are going to do, but it was a very traumatic, for me at least, it was a very traumatic experience because I was watching all of these people praying. I mean, there must have been 100 people praying for this guy. And I'm sure he must have been praying for himself. Just like you people were down there in New Orleans, just praying to Jesus to stop Hurricane Katrina. I mean, people do that, you know, when danger is there. We're not too concerned about God and hurricanes and death and destruction at a cocktail party. I mean, people are drinking and partying and having a good time, figuring out how they can get the neighbor lady laid out in the back of their Chevy van or how they can get off, you know, with her, you know, somewhere. But, you know, we think about more practical things at the office Christmas party than we do about death and abstract things like that. Until you finally come down with cancer yourself. You know, one of these days you'll get cancer. They're promising one person out of one person, 100% cancer in 20 years. So, you know, if you haven't developed cancer yet, be patient. Be patient. Our science, our politics, our medical establishment have promised us 100% cancer by 2020. So this guy is slowly dying, and I'm watching this guy die, but I'm also watching all these people praying for this guy because I'm kind of wondering, as an outsider, is this going to work? Religious people keep telling me about how prayer works and how prayer saves people. And so I wanted to watch this. And this guy is praying, I'm sure, for himself, although I never saw him praying for himself, but I'm pretty sure that if I had cancer, I'd be praying mightily. And I'm pretty sure he was praying. And I was praying for him. I was just real concerned about this guy. And I'm sure that all the rest of these people were praying, and he died. Now, that taught me a lesson. Prayer may save some people sometimes, but it doesn't save everybody all the time, and it didn't save this guy this time. Now, that's what I saw with my own eyeballs. I'm just a reporter reporting that to you. Now, I see some examples in the Scripture where Elijah prayed and raised a boy from the dead. I saw where Daniel prayed, and he saved himself out of the lion's den. So prayer works. I'm not saying that it doesn't. But I just want to emphasize that praying is not a universal cure-all for every problem that we cause ourselves. And many times we, become the proximate cause of our own injury. Now, when you give your dad the finger about the third or fourth time, and he slaps you up alongside the head, and just kicks your ass from one side of the house to the other side of the house, you become what we call in law the proximate cause of your own injury. Now, boys and girls, when we go out here and we deliberately destroy our soil, and then we deliberately refuse to practice land Sabbaths, and then we bring in chemistry as a temporary stopgap measure, and then we bring in genetically modified seeds and hybridized seeds in direct violation of Leviticus 19:19. And then we turn around and pray to God. I would suggest that you not be surprised if he does not answer your prayer. Don't be surprised. I, honest to God, do not believe that we can go on for 100 years giving old dad the finger, and then at the final crucial moment, turn around and say, okay, God, now it's time for you to come in, forgive our sins, and restore our land, and cure our diseases. I just don't think that's going to work. I don't believe it. Now, if you do, get after it. But I think that a more pragmatic approach is going to be some real action. Let's start replacing the chemicals with organic material. So I started doing that here, just like Faulkner had instructed here. Remember, I can't cover everything in the book, so I want to suggest that you get a copy yourself. Remember, I said, go to your local used bookstore, plug into the computer, tell them you want Plowman's Folly, Edward H. Faulkner. He has a program in here for actually rebuilding the soil. So I'm out here buying bales of hay. I can get them for about $5, and I can get them delivered for $5. That's $10. And I can get a big round bale of hay that has been sitting out, and it's rotten. It's no longer good for cattle feed. It's no longer for feeding cows. But I can put that on the ground. I can unroll those bales in long strips. I can place organic material on top of my mineral clay, and I can replace that organic material. Now, I can't do it on the whole 200 or 300 acres all this year or next year, but little by little, and I've been doing this now for 20 years, in addition to that, I can let the land lay, practice a land Sabbath. And, you know, the law requires that we do it once every 7 years, but there's no penalty for doing it twice in 7 years. And I can go out here on a limited basis, and I can pick up the cow manure, and I can put it in my raised beds. I can grow my food for my family and my household on good, wholesome, organic soil. And so can you. You can do it. And you can wean yourself from the chemicals. You can wean yourself from the supermarket. You can wean yourself from the deadly, worthless, useless, chemically, commercially produced fruits and vegetables to something that's organic, to something that's fit to eat. And you can eliminate the cancer that I told you about, Mr. Wegner. Now, Mr. Wegner was a normal city man. He lived out of the supermarket. All of his life, he had lived out of the supermarket. And people who live out of supermarkets develop cancer. I mean, that's just the way life is. And if you develop cancer, you can cure that cancer with juices and vegetables and massive vitamin therapy. Yes, there's a way to do that. But boys and girls, wouldn't we be better advised to prevent the cancer rather than treat the cancer after the fact? I mean, I'm just getting to be old-fashioned here, but I haven't met anybody in my long lifetime, now I'm getting to be pretty old and full of years, I haven't met anybody yet that said to me, I got cancer and I cured it. And boy, what a blast that was. I can't describe how much fun and how pleasurable my 3-year experience with cancer was. And how I ate all or drank all of that wheatgrass and went through all that vitamin therapy and suffered through all of that pain and anguish and had all those boils and sores and all those lesions and all that. And it was so much fun. I just enjoyed myself so well. I haven't run across any yet. And I doubt that you're going to find very many either. Boy, I see a lot of crying. I see a lot of lamenting, a lot of weeping and wailing when people get sick. But you know, when you tell them, you know what causes this sickness over here, boys and girls, is you're eating bad food. Oh, God, they look at you like you're some kind of nut. They don't want to hear that. Now, this guy Faulkner put his finger right on the pulse of the problem. It starts with the moldboard plow, which destroys the organic material in the soil. The destruction of the organic material in the soil is what causes the degeneration of the plants that grow in that soil, which then stretches to the next level. It's the degeneration of the people who eat the degenerate plants that are in the soil, which then causes the diseases and the sicknesses that you have for which you need the medical establishment, for which you need the insurance. There is a long train of abuses here, boys and girls, that go back about 200 years. We are the proximate cause of our own injury. But there's a solution to the problem. That's the bright spot. And I've said this many times. You know, if I came on the air and I said, Jesus, let me tell you the problem. Without a solution, what do you need the problem for? The Sahara Desert's growing by 100 square miles a year. It is an insoluble problem that the people who live there can't solve, and the people in Iowa who don't live there don't give a rat's rectum about anyway. Now, there is a solution to the problem of the Sahara, and it is being addressed on the Mediterranean seacoast by planting trees. Instead of cutting down trees, boys and girls, we need to plant trees. On this farm, we are net planters of trees. We plant more trees than we cut down here on this little microcosm on planet Earth. Now, my neighbors around me are taking down trees as rapidly as possible. They are bulldozing them down. They can't cut them down with chainsaws fast enough, so they get big tractors and caterpillars and bulldoze them down. And it's going to come back to bite us all in the butt, is what it's going to do. But you don't have to participate in the destruction. You can actually solve the problem and be a part of the solution for yourself. Then when you pray to Jesus, he might just hear you. But stop giving him the finger. Hey, we're about out of time. We're going to have to leave it right there. We'll take it up right here next time on the Law Hour, an editorial review talking about Plowman's Folly. Now, you've been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Law School. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening and good night, friends.